You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Welcome to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast, where two evangelical political theorists try to offer some reflections on political theory and the politics of the day. This is Edward Song. I teach in the philosophy department at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California, and I'm joined by Coy O'Neill, who is a political scientist at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. But Coyle and I are not alone today. Faithful listeners of our show will remember the two episodes that we released simultaneously back in the middle of October, about a month before the presidential election, in which we had two guests who had written about their support for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, respectively. The first of those was Rebecca Heinrichs, who holds a master's degree in national security and strategic studies from the U.S. Naval War College and is a fellow at the Hudson Institute, where she writes on issues of nuclear deterrence and national security. Rebecca has provided security briefings to several Republican presidential candidates and congressmen, and her writings have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, the Washington Times, and Politico, among other outlets. She is also a frequent guest on Fox News. Rebecca lives in the Washington, D.C. area with her husband and three kids. Along with Rebecca is Nick Rodriguez. Nick is a graduate of Stanford University and was a Marshall Scholar at the London School of Economics and works as an educational policy and government reform expert in Washington, D.C., where, like Rebecca, he lives with his wife and son. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
So the last time we had you on, the world of politics looked very different than it does now. It was a month before the presidential election at that time. Rebecca expressed some optimism, but I think everyone else thought that the chance of a Trump presidency was a long shot at best. Now we live in a very different world in which Donald Trump is preparing his presidential cabinet and making all the arrangements to become the next president of the United States. I thought that we could pick up on things and start with both of you and just try to go back. It seems like ancient history now, but even going back to the election back in November and asking what your immediate thoughts were after you realized that Trump was going to win the election. Why don't we start with you, Rebecca?
Sure. Well, my immediate feeling was relief and I was excited. I was excited for a couple different reasons. One, leading up to the election, there were many people who were worried that the election was already, stacked against the Republicans. The media was portraying the Republicans, the Republican candidate and his spokespeople inaccurately or taking them out of context in some instances. And so there was just this overwhelming feeling that the deck was just sort of stacked against the Republican candidate. There was some worry that there was some tampering with polling stations, et cetera. So, there was just a lot of discouragement sort of leading up to the election. But to see that Donald Trump won. He became president-elect. It sort of, it was exciting to me to see that the system works, that the people had their voices heard, that the commentariat was wrong, that the media was wrong. And so that was a good thing for democracy, I think. The people went out one by one and voted, and they voted for the extreme underdog who was outspent and really had everything sort of stacked against him. So he didn't have any sort of get out the vote operation that looked comparable to previous Republican candidates, et cetera. So it's really sort of just the self-motivation of the people that went out and voted. So I thought that was an exciting thing. And so now, we got a lot of work to do. And I think that the president-elect is showing himself to be, careful and responsible as he sorts out his cabinet and then the subsequent political appointees that will follow.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of that going into a second. Why don't we turn to you, Nick? What were your immediate thoughts after you realized that Trump was going to win the election?
Yeah, well, I guess the first thought that crossed my mind was really just to ask, I mean, what kind of... Okay, so it was a bit of an extreme reaction. I mean, the first thought that crossed my mind was, what kind of country am I living in? Who exactly are my fellow Americans who voted for this guy? Who exactly are my fellow Christians who voted for this guy? The next thought that crossed my mind was, how exactly am I going to explain to my son what just happened? You know, it was a really personal reaction. I think unlike anything I've ever experienced in an election before. I mean, here you have, you know, a person who ran essentially a campaign that openly appealed to racism, to xenophobia, to a number of other terrible instincts in our culture. And Americans voted for him anyway. They elected him president anyway. And that was a really, really disturbing thing to sort of come away from Election Day with. I think that, you know, as the weeks passed, I started to kind of, you know, sort of tamp down those feelings. I mean, I think it was important for me to kind of get a grip and to say, hey, look, there are, you know, lots of reasons why, you know, why people could have voted for Trump. And it doesn't need to be always sort of, you know, those explanations. But I have to say the first reaction was quite personal and quite visceral.
It sounds like your reaction and my reaction was sort of more or less identical.
Yeah.
Has there been anything since the election that has either made you more pessimistic or more optimistic about a Trump presidency?
So, you know, it's interesting. I'll second what Rebecca said about how I think that if you look at sort of the kind of cabinet picks and the things that are going on, there are sort of reasons to be optimistic that he seems to be picking people that are, if not in the mainstream, at least like a degree of freedom from that mainstream. Like, to give an example from my sort of my own field, which is education. I mean, you know, I don't know that much about Betsy DeVos, but I know she's within the mainstream of conservative thinking on this subject. I might not agree with her on everything, but, you know, she seems like she'd be a sensible person to lead the education department, given who's given what party is in power in the White House. I think that there have been other things I've been, you know, less optimistic about. I think, I guess two things, right? Like, one would be just the kind of weird triumphalism of Christians in the wake of Trump's election. I mean, to be honest, I mean, if you're a believer and you think that Donald Trump's election is an unalloyed good, then I think you're missing part of the picture. But if you check, you know, sort of social media, and you see kind of how just evangelicals and their leaders are reacting to this news, you know, you would think that Christ had been elected president. And that is, I think, particularly disturbing. I mean, the behavior of evangelicals since the election really betrays kind of a callousness towards their brothers and sisters, particularly those from marginalized groups, that I really didn't think or hope was possible. So that's been a reason for pessimism.
Now, to be fair, Nick, I think a number of progressive evangelicals would argue that a kind of Christ has been elected.
Right. Fair enough. Well, you know something? It's interesting you should say that, Coyle, because one of the things I've been preaching to myself in the, you know, in the wake of, you know, not having the election go the way I wanted it to go, was really in kind of saying, look, God ordains every leader. Right? There are a range of possibilities as to why God would have decided that Donald Trump ought to be president. Those range all the way from, on the one end, he's doing it to judge us, whether via an antichrist or, let's just say, a Nebuchadnezzar-type figure, all the way to the other end of, you know, Donald Trump is Paul, waiting for his road to Damascus moment. The Lord delights in using unlikely people to serve his purposes. And who knows? I mean, Donald Trump doesn't seem to have a passing familiarity with the word repent. So if, in fact, anything like that were to happen, gosh, I think we could all, it would be hard for the world not to look at that and say, gosh, it's a miracle. God must have done that. So, you know, God, I think we have to, like, admit that, like, that entire range of possibilities is there in terms of why this man was elected president.
I would love to be able to jump in here on the,
yeah,
on the questions
sorry.
Of race and xenophobia.
Right. Rebecca, I expect that you disagree with about 90% of the things that Nick just said. What are your thoughts on the transition process and his appointment so far?
So I think that his cabinet appointments have been just wonderful. I mean, to me, he looks like he's sort of putting together this all-star cast that many of us conservative Republicans have been wanting for and waiting for from previous presidents. So the great thing about one of the great things about Donald Trump is that he carries with him no baggage. He owes nobody anything, any favors, really. He doesn't have any sort of political baggage. He's sort of coming to this afresh. And so I'm very excited about General Mattis as Secretary of Defense. I'm thrilled about Congressman Price being the head of HHS. He is a committed conservative. He hates socialized medicine. I expect that we are to watch the death throes of Obamacare in the coming year or two. And so I'm thrilled about the picks that he is picking. He's putting women in his cabinet. I only note that to make the point that for all of these accusations of sexism, this is a guy who has been putting women in executive positions within the Trump company, and he's continuing that pattern now within the administration. So I think that that's a great thing. He's just looking for the most qualified, best people, regardless of the sort of identity politics that we've become accustomed to. So I think that's great. I did want to talk a little bit about the racism and xenophobia points, because I completely disagree. I mean, Donald Trump did just as well, if not better, depending on which polls you look at, than previous Republican candidates when it comes to African Americans voting, when it comes to Latinos voting, and certainly when it comes to even women. And we kept hearing how no women were going to turn out and vote for Donald Trump. And it turns out women actually think that he is going to govern the country better for themselves, for their husbands, for their children, better than Hillary Clinton would have. I certainly agree with that. For a president who was supposedly stoking these fears of xenophobia and racism, you had plenty of people vote for him who you would think would sit out if that were the case. I believe even the case of Latinos especially, significantly even higher than, depending on what you would consider significant, than Mitt Romney. What it showed is that Donald Trump actually appealed to a broader American electorate. He was appealing to sort of this basic idea that the United States of America has to get back to protecting itself, protecting the integrity of its borders, getting back to jobs for the American people, and not sort of losing itself as sort of just, you know, a citizen of the world. You know, Donald Trump doesn't see himself as first and foremost a citizen of the world as President Obama does. He sees himself as the head now executive of the United States of America. I think that's perfectly consistent with the biblical principles of taking care of one's own family first. If you look at 1 Timothy 5, I can't remember the verse, but it's in chapter 5, where we are extolled to take care of our family first. And it doesn't mean that we neglect other people, but we certainly have primary responsibilities. And so I think President-elect Trump is sort of getting back to that idea. It's different. He is an unconventional politician. We've seen this before. You know, he's not sort of that much he's out of the mainstream for contemporary politicians, but he's got some Jacksonian tendencies. I try to remind people, too, whenever it comes to his distrust of alliances, et cetera, that's, you know, George Washington and his farewell address, et cetera. So we're sort of getting back to basics about what it means to be an American, what it means to have, you know, citizens who understand what it means to be an American. And so I think all of this bodes well for the country.
So you're saying Trump is sort of George Washington minus the personal virtue and experience.
Well, listen, point taken. I have never, ever, ever made the argument that Donald Trump's own personal character is something to be overlooked or is something to be held up as an example. But what I would say is, I have never looked at political candidates like I'm. I know this is such a. I don't mean to just speak Christianese here, or just what a lot of people who talk about politics who are Christians, but you know, we're not. I'm not looking to, you know, not even just the person who's going to lead my children's school or, you know, teach a Sunday school class. And that's just not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for somebody who's going to govern well. And so I'm not as concerned about some of the things that others are concerned about. And also, again, I'm looking at the two choices that I had, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, when it comes to sort of personal character. I sort of saw it as a wash when it comes to the certain moral issues that we all think about in terms of fidelity and all that kind of thing. So I went with the guy who doesn't have, you know, decades and decades of political corruption. And I went with the guy who I thought ideas would bode better for the country. And so I just wasn't as hung up as others were on some of these sort of personal failings.
Well, and since you know that's been brought up, you know, since I brought that up, do you plan to let your children watch live speeches given by the president?
Live speeches given by the president? Sure. I haven't seen anything. A lot of times I'll read something in the media that people are really upset about that Donald Trump supposedly said, and then I'll go back and I'll read his whole speech and everything he read, you know, everything that he said within context. And I really haven't seen, you know, we haven't heard, for instance, we haven't heard the sorts of comments that he made to Howard Stern many years ago during the campaign cycle. We certainly haven't heard or seen that since he became president-elect. And so I think that there has been, you know, as he has worn different hats and different responsibilities, he has sort of changed the way he talks. So will I be letting my children listen to his Howard Stern interview? Of course not. But I don't see any reason not to let them watch his addresses to the nation, though.
Sorry, Nick, did you want to get in there?
There's a lot to unpack there, and you know, with respect, I know Rebecca and I come at this from different angles. I will say this: it's not hard to find instances of xenophobic and racist and misogynistic rhetoric from Donald Trump in his own words that you can watch on YouTube. Never mind the media. You know, if you think about how he describes the way you're supposed to treat women, if you think about what he, you know, the way he brags about what he does with women, if you think about just his openly mocking a disabled person, I have a child with special needs. Like, what kind of message does that send about the president's regard for people and willingness to protect families like mine? And similar rhetoric about African Americans. So as recently as 2 months ago, saying the Central Park Five, a group of young black men who were exonerated by DNA evidence, were still guilty and deserved to be in jail. All of those are examples of the things that make people of color and members of marginalized groups fearful at the reign of this president. And I'll say this, you may agree with us as brothers and sisters in Christ that our fears are founded or unfounded, but you don't have to agree with us to sympathize with us. And I have seen virtually no sympathy from those on the triumphant right who are celebrating this president.
I would just, in response to that, say, I do think it's important to correct the record on the particular, because I fell for this as well, the particular instance in which Donald Trump became notorious for supposedly mocking the disabled reporter. When I went back, I read a piece that was just sort of a right-wing, you know, unsubstantiated piece. It was a commentator that was saying, if you kind of go back and you look at it, you realize that Donald Trump, the same hand gestures that Donald Trump made that everybody found so offensive and worrisome, as I did as well when I first saw it initially, he's been doing that across the board to all kinds of people who he was basically just saying that they were incompetent and didn't know what they were doing. In fact, he did it in response to Senator Ted Cruz, who is clearly not physically handicapped. So President-elect Trump, when he was candidate, said that he absolutely was not mocking somebody who is disabled, that he would never do that. He's sort of this alpha male type. He doesn't sort of walk around stepping on people who he thinks are physically unable to you know, have physical disabilities. So I do think that's an important one to correct, because I think that would be something, you know, if we have some sort of like genuine bully who doesn't you know, look at handicapped people as people worthy of dignity and respect, that of course would be something to be worried about and be fearful of. But I just don't think that's the case. So a couple of different things. I will say, on the issue of race, I know that there are African American brothers and sisters that I have in Christ who are fearful. I want to be sympathetic to them, even if I don't agree with or understand their fears. But I do think it's important, as the body of Christ, to gently and lovingly help one another to see what is true and what is not true. I hope that if I were to go to somebody with an unfounded fear, that a loving brother and sister in Christ would help me see that I should not be fearful. And so, you know, I'd like to carefully, I hope, with wisdom. It takes a loads amount of wisdom, because I think some people are doing this incredibly poorly. But I hope that Christians who don't see and don't experience the fear that some of our minority brothers and sisters experience would still be able to speak truth gently and help one another and bear each other up. But again, a large number of African Americans came out and supported Donald Trump, who they believe that Donald Trump's ideas about how to help the African American community, how to help establish law and order, would be good for law-abiding, peaceful African Americans in the United States. His ideas about charter schools and school choice are going to help revitalize black schools. All of these things are good for the black family. And so there are plenty of black Americans who, when looking at the choices, voted for Donald Trump. And that's sort of where I agree with. So, again, I don't see where President-elect Trump has been stoking these fears of racism and xenophobia. His immigration policies are clearly not targeted at race. He's talking about the integrity of our borders. And I happen to agree with him on his refugee policy. And that's not out of xenophobia. That's just out of security concerns for the country.
So, Rebecca, just to wrap this up, I guess two quick questions in conclusion, because I know you have to go. First, do you have any thoughts on the recount that apparently Donald Trump is in support of, given that he thinks the election was rigged? And then what do you predict for the next 4 years?
Yeah, so no, I think that the recount is a silly and a waste of energy. But and you know, I again, just to go back, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Donald Trump flipped six blue states that voted for Barack Obama twice, flipped them red this election cycle. So you know, this was a clear, clean sweep in the Electoral College. So it really wasn't a close election at all. So I think the recount is a little bit silly. Now, what can I expect out of the next 4 years? You know, I can't, you know, not to be smart alecky here, but, you know, I don't know. I can't predict the future. But I will say that I do expect the President of the United States to very preoccupied with trying to secure America's borders and have integrity of our borders once again. I think he's going to be very focused on the economy, very focused on jobs. I think he is completely and utterly uninterested in fighting new wars. I think that we will see an end to the United States having these open-ended, undefined foreign policy objectives and goals. I think he's going to have much more limited, clear military objectives if the United States ever does have to intervene overseas. I think General Mattis, as Secretary of Defense, is a giant, bold underscore of that. This is something I have said that we can expect out of Donald Trump, and then General Mattis is just, you know, he's the exclamation point on that. General Mattis doesn't want to fight unended, protracted wars. So I think we can expect that for sure. And then, you know, I think we're going to see a lot of give and take and a lot of pull from Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, other senators who opposed Donald Trump's candidacy, Senator Sasse in the Senate, You know, not all Republicans are the same. This is not a monolith, just like there is no monolith. You know, there is no just not all Black Americans think the same way. Not all women think the same way. Not all Hispanics do. Not all Republicans do. So I think you're going to have some wonderful, vibrant discourse and discussion about what direction we want to go with the country on many different foreign policy and domestic policy areas. And I think all of that is going to be great for the American democratic system. So, you know, one last point on that. I think everybody sort of outcry coming from the commentariat in front of from the right and the left on President-elect Trump taking the phone call from the Taiwanese, the leader of Taiwan, I think is you know, I'm getting a big kick out of it because there's nothing wrong with him doing so. But because he doesn't sort of fall in line with bipartisan orthodoxy on some things, you know, a lot of people are going to be upset about it. But, you know, we're going to have to get back to basics. Make your argument. And if your argument isn't going to persuade the President of the United States, it's not going to be an argument that wins the day. So, you know, so I think we're going to have to get back to making good arguments, first principles, and persuading the President and his administration about what we want to do with the country. But I don't think he's an ideologue at all. You know, and so we sort of get to go back to the drawing board on some of this stuff, and I think that's a good thing.
Well, right, he's clearly not an ideologue. It's the question goes the other way. Does he believe anything other than himself?
Well, of course. I think what he's trying to do, he is, if not actually, technically, he is sort of culturally, in many ways, a blue-collar working-class American. He really is. This is why so many of that particular socioeconomic class identified with him. And so he sort of is the common sense. He's sort of a bellwether sort of common sense man. And so he wants to do what is best for the United States of America. He wants to do what is best for the American people. And if you try to make an argument about some sort of internationalist, globalist, you know, abstract argument, that there sort of has just been bipartisan, it's just the sort of the way we've always done it, it's just not gonna win the day. You're going to have to come back with, does this help Americans? Is it good for the country? Does it actually uplift and help Americans in general? And we need to stop with this sort of identity politics nonsense where we're just sort of breaking up the country in a bunch of different factions and trying to appeal to different types of people on that regard. So I
assume you mean he's speaking to the blue collar, not that he is. I mean, I would be surprised if Donald Trump had ever done a day of manual labor in his life.
Well, actually, Donald Trump actually brought on that point. I'm talking about sort of culturally, sort of like the ethos, the way these people actually think and operate. You know, one of my jobs that I had when I was in high school, I worked at a plant. I worked in the accounting department of this particular plant. But it was a plant. You know, there has a out on the floors. There was just a bunch of machines, guys standing on the line, working there all day and making minimum wage and. My uncle still works in that plant, and a lot of the things my uncle says and has said over the years are things that I see Donald Trump saying. It's just a sort of very blunt, common sense. It's a way of thinking about things. Actually, Donald Trump, I've read that he would bring his children. You know, Donald Trump sort of is notorious for bringing his children on work sites, on job sites. And because he wanted his children to actually see how things are made and how businesses are constructed and made. And so, you know, if he isn't the one that actually was, cementing cinder blocks, he's certainly been around it and knows the people who have. So he's very familiar with that. And, you know, if he's not a builder in terms of practically with his own hands, he certainly knows how to build businesses, and he's been around the people who have actually done a lot of the hard labor. So we'll see. You know, he's won the favor. You can't discount half the country that voted for him. I think we have to start. I'm encouraged that Nick has sort of had a new take, or a little bit after the initial emotions sort of were overwhelming at first, that these aren't terrible racist xenophobic people who voted for Donald Trump. They're not.
And Rebecca, can I just say one thing about that? Because I do think it's One thing that has been a great comfort to me in the last month has been to hear, you know, to speak with Christian conservatives that I respect, people like you, and to hear their confidence in where things are going. I have to say that, you know, I have all my, you know, disagreements, things that I don't agree with, that, you know, that you believe in, and so on and so forth. But it counts for a lot that a brother in Christ, that a sister in Christ, a person who I know is a person of character, is vouching, if not for the man, then for kind of the party around the man and for what his administration's going to do. So I just wanted to say that and to note that, you know, I count you among those people. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, Nick. And again, I really do hope that many people who have been very frustrated and come out very, very enthusiastically throughout the general election against him for all of the reasons that you did mention initially in this interview, to sort of give him a shot. I do think, maybe not him personally, but what his policies are going to try to do. I really do think that he would see it as a great achievement if we could go in and revitalize some of these schools and give inner city kids an opportunity at a great education. And he might not kind of come at it right away like many on the left of the political aisle would want him to do, but I do think that is certainly something that he would see as a great achievement of his administration. So, you know, there are going to be some attempts, I think, to his credit, at breaking into some of these minority communities that other Republican policymakers simply haven't tried to do in recent history. And so we should look forward to those opportunities. And I think he's going to be a guy who's going to look for bipartisan cooperation and new coalitions. And so, yeah, I'm optimistic. I'm not, you know, this is messy and it's politics. It can go a bunch of different directions, but I am optimistic.
So first of all, apologies to the listeners. We have been struggling through some technical difficulties in this particular episode, capturing people's audio and then the audio quality. We've been having a little bit of trouble hearing each other. And at this point, Rebecca has had to depart us. So now we continue on, and it's just Coyle, Nick Rodriguez, and myself. You know, Rebecca, right before I lost all of the audio, Rebecca was making a claim trying to defend some of the remarks that Trump has made that have been construed as being racist or misogynistic. And specifically, she was making the point about the disabled reporter. I wanted to chime in on that. But Nick, I know that you had some thoughts on that as well. Do you want to jump in here on that?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's interesting. I understand the defense Rebecca's making. Right, which is to say, you know, it wasn't about disabled people in general, it was just about this person, and he was kind of directing his anger at this person. There's an interesting article out in Slate magazine at Liberal Rag about the psychology of Donald Trump, you know, like what it takes to manipulate him. And it talks about how he can go from friend to foe in an instant, and how when he's your friend, you can do no wrong. And when he's your enemy, he will hurt you in the sort of most violent and painful way possible. And so the best defense you can come up for Donald Trump was, oh, he wasn't being prejudiced against Americans with disabilities. He was just being super vindictive at that one person. And by the way, that applies to kind of everyone else he's ever insulted. It's a defense. I'm just not sure it's a very good one.
Well, I think a better response to the charges of racism was made by that article that's been going around from, was it Slate Star Codex? I think the title was something like "You're Still Crying Wolf," and the argument is basically: look, if you actually look into Donald Trump's policies and the broader context of the things he's saying, there's a lot not to like about Donald Trump. The author of this is in no way a Trump supporter, but to say that we want to crack down on illegal immigration is not an intrinsically racist statement. It's just saying we want to crack down on illegal immigration.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Go for it.
No,
go ahead.
Yeah, so you and I have been you posted that to Facebook, and we've been chiming in on that. I can't remember if you posted that on your own personal feed or if that was on the City of Man Facebook.
Oh, I put it
page.
On both. It was a great article.
Yeah, so there have been a whole series of articles sort of on the liberals have been crying wolf for a long time, and now when there's finally a wolf, no one will listen to them, and sort of kind of explaining away the more outrageous things that Donald Trump has been saying. And like, to me, it's perfectly possible that Donald Trump is not a racist in the sense that whenever he sees a non-white person, he doesn't automatically jump to the conclusion that they are inferior just because of their race. Like, I don't know that he's a racist in that sense. And for any given controversial thing that Trump has said, it's you know, you could come up with a kind of a justification for trying to say why that shouldn't be construed as being racist or not. But when you look at the totality of things that he has said, and I mean, I didn't find Rebecca's explanation of the remarks to the disabled reporter particularly compelling. But again, not that I think that every time he sees a disabled person, he sees them as being, you know, inherently inferior or not. But like the trend that you see, even if he isn't a good old-fashioned, unreconstructed racist, he's certainly the kind of person who quite intentionally is more than happy to appeal to that kind of to resort to that kind of language in order to appeal to those people for whom that language is motivating. You know, he's perfectly happy to manipulate that kind of racist language for his own ends. And that to me, so is that better than being a good old-fashioned unreconstructed racist? I mean, I guess, but I just feel like that's a distinction that isn't particularly significant.
Well, and that's a conversation we had in the earlier episode, right? I mean, you don't, in politics, you don't necessarily attribute that to the person saying it, just as we don't necessarily think Hillary Clinton really believes evangelical Christians are all haters of homosexuals, but doesn't stop her campaign from using the language, right? It doesn't stop them from touting that at their convention. So, well, yeah, I mean, you're right. It's language that he shouldn't be using, maybe politically, but it's also, yeah. And again, I'll just say go read the article. It makes the point fairly well.
Yeah. Well, Aquil, two thoughts on that before we move on to the next topic. Just one is, and I'm meaning to write a post about this at some point when I get around to it. I feel like we have been defining the definition of racism so strongly that short of like a George Wallace type figure saying segregation today, segregation forever in public, like no one can be called a racist. You know, as some people have put it, it's sort of like, you know, we've gotten to the point where it's a bigger deal to call somebody a racist than it is to actually be one. And I think there's an interesting psychology there, because if you push me, I would tell you, you know, I, like most human beings, have like racist tendencies, and I'm a person of color who's married to another person of color. You know, and yet we're afraid to admit it. Like, it's a sin we're afraid to confess. It's really quite striking to me. And because people are so afraid of being tarred with that label, they don't see, like, what's right in front of their face. It's kind of like, how much more racist would the Republican nominee have to be for everyone to be comfortable simply saying, yeah, I think he's a racist, you know? Like, I mean, Donald Trump kind of convinces me that there is no limit. and I think that's disturbing.
Yeah, and again, it's such a vague word in some ways. Like, if you, other than, you know, people who are openly Klansmen, right?
Right,
exactly. The way the word gets used, I mean, like you said, it does seem that everyone is racist. And I think the word has to have some more substance than that. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, there is the sense that we are all sinners, and yeah, racism is certainly a part of that. I would never disagree with that. But in the same way, we're all idolaters. That doesn't mean that all of us are literally bowing down in front of statues.
Right.
There needs to be some kind of substance to that word to make the accusation worthwhile.
Yeah. And I would argue that a hawkish immigration policy by itself, right, you're right, isn't necessarily racist. A hawkish immigration policy plus comments about Judge Curiel plus calling Mexicans rapists kind of asks you to wonder, what is the motivation behind the policy, and what does that mean for how the policy will be carried out, right, with kind of with prejudice and malice, or in a way that kind of is trying to accomplish some greater, more legitimate end, right? So I do think those differences matter.
Plus talk about registering Muslims in our country, plus talk from some Trump advisors talking, you know, justifying the internment of Japanese Americans during the Second World War. You know, you sort of add all of that. You know, for any one of those things, you could say, oh, you know, he wasn't really close to Trump. You know, he isn't really, you know, for any of those things, you can say, oh, you can sort of explain it away. But, like, you take the totality of all of those things, and it seems to me that the fear of minority persons in this country seems perfectly reasonable.
And so what we're left now with is the hope that his nastiness is, in fact, individualized and not group and general oriented. That the hope we're left clinging to is that he's just a vindictive bully, not a racist vindictive bully. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and I actually don't disagree with that. I mean, I don't think he's a racist, vindictive bully. I just think he's a bully, though I do think that he's the kind of person who's happy to use racist language to explicitly in order to motivate people to get things done. I mean, he basically admitted as much in his 60 Minutes interview, in which he said, you know, I said a lot of things. Sometimes you need to say things to motivate people. Yeah. And so, it, you know, it's better to have somebody who isn't explicitly a racist but is happy to use that language and use than to have somebody who's, like, explicitly a racist, but it's not as if that's harmless. And you look, you know, there are all these horrible stories about attacks on persons of color. Just yesterday there was a story about a woman on the subway in New York City who was wearing a hijab who was harassed by two white men. They were trying to rip her hijab off her. There's a crazy story about the dude on the airline who was yelling at people, and it looks like attacks targeting minorities are up around the country, you know, and like that has a, like, it's not just idle language, it's not just talk, it's not just tough talk, it's like tough talk that is having real effects on real people in the country, and that's what makes a lot of persons of color nervous.
Yeah. And you know, Quail, one thing I'm going to write in another post, which I hope to have up by the time this podcast drops, is that, you know, the best thing kind of white evangelicals or evangelicals in general who voted for Trump can do to show unity, even as they prepare to govern, even as they kind of try to help this president be successful, is to reassure, like, their black and brown brothers and sisters, like, the second he does anything that crosses that line, I'll be right there with you. You know, I'll stand with him on a lot of things, but not on this. If your worst fears end up being vindicated, I will be there to defend you. That's a reassurance I'd like to see more of, I think, out of those, you know, kind of Christians who supported Trump.
And I think that is a good thing to do. But again, I want specifics. Like, what specifically are you concerned that Trump will do?
Yeah, so a couple. So I think the idea of a Muslim registry is a problem because it's an attack on the religious liberty of one, therefore an attack on the religious liberty of all.
And I would be totally on board with you in that. And I don't know anything about the whatever the Muslim registry proposal was that the, you know, advisor number 57 or whatever suggested. Would you be opposed to it if it were a refugee registry, which from what I vaguely remember was something of the context of that?
I mean, tougher to know, right? Like, without knowing, I don't know the specifics at that point either. I understand the argument that you're making, and you're right that the specifics matter. I mean, a couple of other examples, Quail, since you asked for them, right? Like, so if I think about, I mean, you know, I was a little disappointed that, you know, Rebecca talked about, like, election tampering, because this whole kind of phantom of voters, of kind of voter fraud that conservatives like to talk about when there's zero evidence for it, as a pretext for essentially voter suppression, right? Like where a federal judge found that the North Carolina GOP essentially designed its law around where do black people vote? How do they vote? Now let's structure the voting system to curtail those means of voting as best as we possibly can. It was literally racially motivated. And by the way, lots of other legislatures do this. The North Carolina folks were just dumb enough to put it in writing. And you know, most people who do kind of racially motivated voter suppression are smarter than that. So it never kind of comes out that clearly. But, you know, you think about all the rhetoric about voter ID. I mean, this is a mainstream view within the Republican Party now that it's okay to suppress the vote to help our party, even when that suppression falls very clearly along color lines. And that's a problem, right? It could be a means of entrenchment of a permanent minority government. And yes, I mean, Donald Trump's 46% of the populace minority government in that case.
And again, I am perfectly on board with saying, hey, if that is the intent behind the law, yes, we ought to oppose it. That's not the same thing as saying whenever voter registration laws come up, if we're not opposing them, we're racist.
Yeah, but it's hard to draw the distinction between those things. I mean, ever since the Supreme Court ruling,
we have this case in North Carolina that is clearly, at least according to the evidence we've seen so far, clearly being driven by suppressing, you know,
okay,
voters.
Yeah, okay. So
and on the other hand, we have cases that are clearly, look, just have a photo ID of some kind when you show up to vote.
But I think
so that's fine. But what about in Texas? Like Texas has 403 fewer polling places after the Supreme Court made its ruling on the. Federal election laws, like
The Voting Rights Act.
Arizona has 212 fewer polling places. Like, what are we to make of that? Just because there isn't a smoking gun, Louisiana has 100 fewer polling places. Alabama has 66 fewer polling places. Like, and like, you know, you and I think talked briefly about election security and things like that. And I mean, in the abstract, like the idea of making sure that there isn't voting fraud obviously makes a lot of sense. But when you look at the specific content of the legislation in the vast majority of states, it looks like they're sort of written precisely with the aim of disenfranchising minority voters.
Well, I think what's frustrating...
And for the record, I don't actually think there's voter fraud going on. I think by and large, our elections are... fair and well done and mostly exactly what we would expect, right? I mean,
has become mainstream, right? Even for someone like Rebecca, which I'm sure it's not like her main thing, right? But like, you know, like she was like, yeah, there'll be tampering. It's a mainstream GOP position now to say Democratic voters are fraudulent voters. And that justifies any manner of kind of restrictions that we pass in order to make it harder for those voters to vote. That's problematic even if it's just partisan in motivation. It's problematic, especially, of course, if it's racial in motivation. And I think, well, the problem with only holding like the North Carolina case to account in this is that most people who do racially motivated bias things are smarter than that, right? Yeah. They know not to leave a smoking gun. So you actually have to suss out the nuance of the facts. You have to say, okay, look, voter fraud in theory could be a problem. There is no evidence that there is voter fraud of this kind. So when I see a legislature that's GOP dominated going on and on and on about it and passing these laws, I think some inference of why they did that is acceptable, right? Even if there isn't an actual kind of record of it. And it may not be like, hey, you're racist, but it may be you're racially insensitive. You don't care that the consequence of your making a power grab is that black and brown voters get effectively disenfranchised, right? And in fact, that's actually the more common type of racism, right? It's not like I am an unreconstructed racist who wants to put black and brown people in their place. It's I'm willing to overlook when other people do that or when that is an unintended consequence because it's just not really on my radar. It's a different category of error, absolutely, but it's an error nonetheless, and it's one that we ought to be calling out.
But it's hopefully one that, as someone who's on your side of the issue, you can see maybe why evangelicals wouldn't line up with you on it.
Right? Well,
if there isn't that smoking gun, is it wrong to take the other side of an issue where there's not the clear evidence one way or another? So you can say, well, but the inference is, but the other side can say, hey, yeah, but the inference is actually this other thing instead.
Well, yeah. But I mean, so just because there isn't a smoking gun doesn't mean that one inference is just the same as another inference. Right?
It just means that your side wins? I mean, how does that
No, so you look at the evidence. But so, Coy, here's a case. In Medina County, which is a heavily Republican area in South Texas, they closed the only polling place in the town of Natalia, which is 75% Latino, and the only Democratic-leaning part of the county. So why did they close that polling place? So what you don't have is you don't have a memo saying, hey, let's shut this down so those dark-skinned people can't vote, right? But and what other conclusion do you come to about that particular case?
Yeah, I know nothing about that case. So, again,
well, so there's a case.
So
okay, there's a case.
So and I would 403. I would point to a voting law like the one we passed in Missouri, which I think is sort of the epitome of reasonableness. Just our legislature is run by Republicans. Basically, it's show us something that says that you live where you say you live. And if you don't have whatever it is, show up at the county clerk's office before the election, and we will, like, the state will pay for you to find whatever it is that you need to find. So, again, example and counterexample. I don't know your case.
So, Coy, so yes, no, so that's fine. So, your Missouri case, I have no problem with that. But 403 polls closed since the Shelby case in Texas. I just, what do we make with that? What do we make of that?
The Supreme Court literally said in that case, we don't need Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act anymore because these places that historically disenfranchise people of color no longer do that. And then immediately after that ruling comes down is a flood of this kind of legislation from exactly those places that has the net effect of disenfranchising people of color. So to cheer that, which, by the way, there's not a strict constructionist argument for that at all. It was a nakedly partisan decision by the Roberts Court. Is problematic. And so going back to the Christian point, Coyle, what I'd say is this. If you're a Christian, you owe it to your black and brown brothers and sisters to not simply hew to the party line on this. I don't even care about you being like, oh, those guys are racist. You don't need to say that. You just need to say, you know what, on balance, I can't come down on this side of the issue. You're basically trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist in order to accumulate more partisan power for yourselves. I would love to see more Christians think independently about that. I'd love to see Rebecca say, I love Donald Trump on all these things, but on this one thing, I can't stand with him because there just doesn't seem to be any justification for that. But I am guessing most evangelical supporters of Donald Trump aren't even thinking about that, and that's the problem.
Right, and again, I do not disagree with that. I just want to be clear that we're going both directions with that. Right. So yes, evangelicals on that one side of the voting issue need to say, hey, I understand where the other side is coming from, but that needs to go the other way also. That they're, from the other side, hey, there are people who genuinely think there's voter fraud going on, who think that Democrats are filling buses with illegal immigrants and taking them to the polls.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think that's actually happening, but there are people who deeply believe that, and as a result, they support these sorts of voter fraud laws or voter ID laws.
Yeah.
While I don't agree with the premise, I understand why you think that.
So that's fine, but
so I
but
guess
then
the,
you
I'm just saying the charity has to go both ways.
That's right, but our criticism isn't directed towards those people who think that. It's directed towards people who are like propagating this myth that there's widespread voter fraud.
Yeah, absolutely. And those who join
who are those people? Like, who are those people? They're not just the man on the street. Like, they are Donald Trump for one, and then Mike Pence is perfectly happy to support it, and the Speaker of the House is perfectly happy to let it slide and not call it out. So that's fine. If I were in their shoes, so your average Republican voter who is worried about this. If I were in their shoes and read only the same things that they read, I would believe it too. So I sympathize with them. But it's all the mainstream figures who are propagating this myth.
Yeah.
But I understand.
And how come there are no Republican leaders who are like, this is crazy. We got to stop propagating these lies.
Yeah, and for
well, they actually did.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, just during the election, there was that great moment when Trump was talking about it being rigged, and I don't remember if it was Rince Priebus or if it was other party leadership who stepped in and was like, look, Republicans control the majority of offices of Secretary of State in this country. You can't say the election's rigged.
Right.
Because we're the ones who are running the elections. So there was pushback.
Yeah, okay, good. So I appreciate that. And I think you had noted Evan McMullen's recent comments critical of Trump recently, which I very much appreciated.
Right.
But there are certainly a lot of other Republican figures who are both – who are either happy to propagate the myth or are willing to stand idly by when they know it's false. Your chief among them, the vice president and the Speaker of the House.
And I would love for Christians to distinguish themselves by saying no. Like, that is not something we will join you in. That's I think, what I'd like to see more of just in general is just Christians kind of trying to be more sensitive on these issues. They can have all the other kind of conservative principles they want. They can say, yep, no more Obamacare, cut Medicare, get rid of all of it. right? None of that stuff is kind of like in the voting issue territory of kind of racial bias. But this is. And so I would love to see Christians distinguish, politically active Christians distinguish themselves by kind of being a different kind of conservative if they decide that they're going to be conservatives.
Well, right. And I would even say, I would even go a step beyond that and say, look, if you are in favor of voter ID laws, you need to be in favor of encouraging the state passing those laws to make them as generous as possible. And again, I'll hold up my own state as an example of that basically says, look, if for whatever reason you don't have the documents necessary, we will help you get them. Like, we will facilitate that for you, because the goal is not to keep people from voting. It's just to make sure that only citizens are voting. And if that means we spend some state money doing it, then so be it.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's exactly right.
So there are ways to balance that if you must have the law. I guess we kind of got sidetracked with the voting ID thing. Yeah.
And I feel bad. I brought up Rebecca a couple times. My apologies.
No. It's okay.
Yeah.
We could continue to talk about these issues in perpetuity. Nobody's even mentioned Steve Bannon yet.
I have a couple things I wanted to say about Steve Bannon. So here's the deal. Like, I was going to say, I've been broadly encouraged by the kind of, call it, conventionalness of the cabinet level kind of picks that Trump has made. Only because they're broadly conventional. You suspect, right? He knows these guys got to get confirmed by the Senate and so on and so forth. Bannon is a particularly tough case, I think, for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are two versions of bad here, right? One version of bad is the strong version of bad. It's, you know, he's in a mind meld with the alt-right people, you know, who are at Breitbart.com, and that's really, really not good, right? It basically means you've got a white supremacist as chief counselor to the president, and nobody's calling him out on it. Now, I'm going to step away from that for a second, because I understand that, like, not everybody agrees that that's actually what Steve Bannon is. But let's go with some sort of a weaker version of that case, right? If you give him the benefit of the doubt, the story is basically, well, he ran the website, but he never said any of those things. So what he really believes is a much, you know, sort of weaker version of what he would call, or what we would call, the ethno-nationalist kind of case. His own words, his own speeches, they suggest that at a minimum, he basically believes in sort of the clash of civilization. That, you know, in the battle for America's soul, it's the so-called Judeo-Christian West versus everyone else. And this kind of leads you to similar conclusions, right? I'm uncomfortable with shifting demographics. We got to stop immigration. We got to stop these refugees, because he's basically worried about the cultural continuity of the so-called Judeo-Christian rest. Now, in one sense, you could say, okay, fair enough. I understand that view. You know, in the years after 9/11, before I was a Christian, I had that view. But the problem with that view is twofold. First, it smushes those three words together, Judeo-Christian West. This is a frequent and, I think, dangerous category error. It's one that essentially reduces the God of the universe once again to a mere God of a tribe of people. It's damaging to our witness as Christians to buy into this story. It basically tells Black and Brown and Arab and Asian and African Christians that because they're not culturally as Western as white evangelicals, they're not welcome. That there's an ethnic and cultural test for following Christ. I really can't think of anything more poisonous or dangerous to our witness as a church, right? Both here and abroad. But the second problem with
aside from the irony that when you look at what it is to be Judeo, or you look at the roots of the early church, it has nothing to do with the West. It has everything to do with the ancient Near East.
Yeah, but exactly. No, I mean, even funnier, right? But the second problem with the view is just the practical endpoint of it. So suppose you buy it. You say, okay, we're really in a clash of civilizations. What do you do about the fact that half of all children under 5 are non-white, and more and more and more of them are coming from these so-called other civilizations? I mean, all the immigration hawkery and walls that you build will not stop this from happening, right? So what do you do as this cohort rises and comes into its own, and you think they're a mortal threat to the soul of the country? I mean, I know my answer to that question, right? You work through the messy and pluralistic reality of trying to draw a diverse society together. That's the work we've been engaged in, arguably, for most of our history. I think that's consistent with the biblical view. But if you believe in the clash of civilizations, there's no give there. When push comes to shove, you're backed into the corner of doing some pretty nasty things, right? So suppressing voters is just like the tip of the iceberg. You can strip people of citizenship, or you can find ways to, you know, get rid of them. I mean, what else is there if you prize Judeo-Christian culture above all else? So really, Steve Bannon, even the weak version of Steve Bannon, is absolutely terrifying to me. It's terrifying to me that somebody like that, even if he isn't actually a neo-Nazi, has the ear of the most powerful person in the world. And it should be terrifying to all Christians who care about our witness in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you saw the remarks that he made to the Vatican.
That's what I'm basing this on, mostly, right?
So, I mean, and it's really clear that, I mean, so you can step aside from reading between the lines, and there's some instances in which, you know, he just writes the lines in which he thinks that a multi-ethnic civilizations
don't work.
Inherently unstable. They don't work. And that the United States is a white nation, and so we should make efforts to sort of preserve this white ethno-nationalism. All right, so that is white ethno-nationalism.
Right.
Does he believe that non-white people are inferior? Maybe not. But again, that to me is a distinction that doesn't really make a difference. You know, on his own radio show, he was interviewing Donald Trump. This was some years ago, and he was sort of complaining about all the Asian people in Silicon Valley.
I remember that quote. Exactly. And it's sort of like, again, where do you go once push comes to shove, right? Like, that path only leads to terrible, like, terrible things.
Yeah. And, you and Coyle were making this point a little bit earlier about, you know, what line has to be crossed before Christians of all stripes stand together and say, no, we're drawing a line here.
Right.
And, you know, and certainly things like internment camps or registration for Muslims would be something that gets everybody's attention. But I mean, to me, the thing that worries me isn't like these injustices at the level in which everybody would suddenly spring to attention, but it's sort of the what's the frog in the pot, right? It's slowly turning up the temperature so that things that previously would have garnered a lot of tension and worry sort of it's the normalizing of an ever increasing level of radicalism, right?
Can we just call that the slippery slope?
We could call that a slippery slope, but you know, it encourages low level violence against minority persons, and then we sort of get used to that, and nobody notices that.
Yep.
And
that's right.
Anyways.
Yeah. No. It's a huge issue, and my only silver lining for it is that perhaps over time we'll say, all right, well, we're confronting it out in the open as opposed to kind of like, you know, in quiet and in secret. And as a result, maybe it's a boil we can finally lance. But I don't know. I haven't been encouraged by what I've seen thus far.
Well, Nick, with this this long and glitchy episode, we first lost Rebecca and we've now lost Ed. So let's just wrap up with the last two questions that we asked Rebecca. What do you think about the recount? And what are your predictions for the next 4 years?
For the recount, I'm sure that, they have a right to request it. I'm sure that's fine. I'm aware, as anybody else is, that it's not likely to change the outcome. So I think the important thing about the recount is just that if you're going to request that, you're not going to sort of say, and I think it's going to change the outcome. And I think most of the kind of sensible folks on the left have said exactly that. I wonder if the same would be the case if the shoe were on the other foot. I kind of have serious reason to question that. More broadly, on the kind of electoral question generally, I think one thing that I think a lot of people on the left have been chattering about is the kind of split between the electoral college and the popular vote. And I will say, right, if it keeps happening, right, like we're going to have like a Democratic deficit problem. That's not a partisan issue, right? If it went the other way, you know, it would be equally problematic. But I do hope that it's something that becomes a part of the conversation in the future. Let's see. So what do I expect out of the next 4 years? Like Rebecca, I'm not able to see the future. I have a couple of thoughts. Number one, I think Christians are likely to be disappointed. I'm pretty sure there's going to be zero reversal on gay marriage. Scalia seat's probably going to get filled with a Scalia clone. And we'll probably just restore the status quo. Even if something does change, say because a liberal justice retires or dies, I think that, you know, what you're going to see is, you know, the, as I've said before, the number of abortions that take place won't really change much either. I mean, the number may even rise if some of Republicans' pet projects on restricting access to health care and contraception bear fruit. And something worse is possible here, right? That, you know, beyond the normal stuff that, you know, Trump might do, that he does something so unacceptable, so beyond the pale, that he doesn't survive it. And all of evangelical Christianity, if that happens, will be tarred with that. I mean, how else can you interpret the record-breaking evangelical support that he got in this election? At the same time, like, I think Christians will be disappointed, but I think they will also be too proud to admit that they've been disappointed. And they'll double down on this guy 4 years from now. Whenever Donald Trump does something bad, they'll just reach for an old refrain. They'll say, Hillary Clinton would have been worse. My hope is that they'll stop grading the presidency on a curve and hold Donald Trump to the basic standards of decency that they apply to their own families, their own congregations, their own friends and colleagues, rather than turn a blind eye to what he does. But to be honest, I'm not holding my breath. I pray that I'm wrong. I pray that Trump governs like a conventional Republican and doesn't make any big, you know, kind of country-threatening mistakes. Then the rest of my friends who voted for Trump will be entitled to do a little bit of gloating, and that'll be justified. And in that case, I might even be compelled to vote for myself, you know, in 4 years if he's really just a conventional Republican. I actually may be more optimistic that Donald Trump is going to kind of muddle through than I am optimistic that the witness of the church is going to survive unscathed through this episode in the next 4 years. So that's kind of where I stand on it right now.
Well, I was not expecting I might vote for him in 4 years to be a part of that answer. So good job catching me off guard there.
No. Think about the logic there, right? Which is to say, you know, in my last blog post, I said, hey, you know, I've become convinced that I might become a single issue voter, right?
Sure.
The thing that kept me from that with Donald Trump was the fear that he would do something terrible. If 4 years passes and he's a bit of a weird but mostly conventional Republican, then in some ways that argument will have been taken away from me, won't it? So I'll have to decide then. Now, all that being said, there is another kind of undertone to this that I've been thinking about a lot as a result of this election. You know, because on the one hand, I can tell you, yeah, I'm not that confident in Donald Trump. I hope he, you know, only, you know, has 4 years in office. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to be all about, like, rebuilding the Democratic Party either. I mean, I've already talked to you about why I don't really belong in either party. And so one thing I'm interested in is starting to kind of, I don't know, find other Christians who feel the way I do and start to, I mean, building a movement. That's a bit of a broad statement to make for somebody like me. But just to kind of get Christians together who are defined at least by an unwillingness to continue to sign on to the entire conservative agenda, lock, stock, and barrel. People who aren't happy with the state the Republican Party has degenerated into. I mean, in a way, I would tell you, and I think others have said this, you know, Donald Trump kind of represents the reductio ad absurdum of, like, the worst of the Republican id. This isn't to say that there aren't good things about Republicans and conservatism, but it's sort of like he represents, like, the bizarro, dark side of all that stuff. And the fact that the Republican Party, like, could be captured by that does make me wonder about it long term. Now, it doesn't make the Democratic alternative any better, but it does make me wonder, do Christians need to be awakened, essentially, to the proposition that they shouldn't just kind of vote so consistently for one party as they do, even if the alternative is voting for nobody at all? So that's something that I hope to wrestle with over the course of the next 4 years. Yes, one possible outcome is I just sort of give up and say, fine, I'm voting for Trump and holding my nose. But I hope to kind of fight to explore the other possibilities as well.
Well, we certainly look forward to following along with you on your blog and in conversations like this as you think about that. Thanks so much, Nick, for coming on the show with us. And thank you all of you for listening in. You have been listening to the City of Man podcast. Again, a special thanks to Nick Rodriguez, whose blog you can read at nowtellnovember.com, where he has a new blog post up. And thanks to Rebecca Heinrichs, who you can read at The Federalist and various other places around the web. And thanks again to all of you for joining in. If you have comments or questions, please feel free to post them on the show notes at christianhumanist.com. Send us an email at thecityofman@gmail.com. Or comment on our Facebook page. The City of Man is a program on the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Be listening again for the next episode of City of Man. And as always, render unto Caesar things that are Caesar's, and render unto God things that aren't.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.